Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We are today talking about the Galapagos Islands and the giant tortoises and all the other wildlife that inhabit that area, and what their story tells us about conservation, maybe a little about history as well, and ecotourism. It's all wrapped up in a new book written by our guest today, Elizabeth Hennessy. She's an assistant professor of history and environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's got a great new book out. It's called On the Backs of Tortoises, Darwin, the Galapagos, and the Fate of an Evolutionary Eden. So talking with her about, kind of about the history of the Galapagos and wrap that into the environmental work that's being done there. Some of it's probably been good over the years, some of it maybe not so good, as we visit with her. And I certainly hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Maybe you visited the Galapagos Islands. Maybe you want to know some more about those tortoises or about the islands. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Elizabeth Hennessy, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on, Larry.
Well, I tell you what, the Galapagos, you referred to it as an Eden, as an evolutionary Eden. You're not the only one to do that. What's an evolutionary Eden?
That's a great question. For me, the evolutionary Eden is because Galapagos didn't have an indigenous human population, and so they were mostly unpopulated by humans until about 500 years ago. And because Darwin went there, and we popularly think that Darwin discovered evolution in the Galapagos, they have become, over the 20th century, the site of a biological origin story, a place that Darwin said was the origin of all his views. And so that has gotten wrapped up in the conservation world and taken really seriously as a really important place that conservationists need to protect because of that history.
And that history is really interesting. I mean, compared to how we view the islands today, the original history of it is quite different than I think how people look at it today.
Yeah, it is indeed. And that was one of the more surprising things for me as I went about this research, because I think most people in North America and the U.S. know Galapagos. Maybe you've been there on a tour and are lucky enough to do that. But most of us know it, I think, from nature documentaries or National Geographic articles. And what we see in those are images of wildlife, of quote-unquote pristine landscapes that look like they haven't been touched by humans. And that's really not the case with Galapagos. There were penal colonies on the islands when Darwin visited and afterwards. There were sugarcane plantations, cattle ranches, all these things that have really shaped the islands and the people that live there today.
Interesting to me that the early sailors and how they used the tortoises, mainly, I think.
Yeah, that's the other major component of the human history of Galapagos, were these sailors who went for hundreds of years. And the Galapagos are actually named for the tortoises. They were named by Spanish sailors way back in the 16th century because Galapagos is an old Spanish word for tortoise. And so the sailors went to the islands predominantly because they thought the tortoises were so delicious. And they had they were a great source of meat for people to take on their boats as they went on these month-long voyages across the Pacific. And then they also have a lot of fat, and so that fat could be rendered into oil for cooking. It was also a really important source of food.
And over time, I mean, there were, I think you had a number, but there were thousands and thousands of tortoises that were used in that fashion.
There were. The scientists today estimate that there were at least 200,000 tortoises in the Galapagos way back when, and today about 20,000 of them remain. So the population really was decimated by those sailors, by island colonists, and also by natural historian collectors who would collect the animals to take to museums to study.
Yeah, so we were playing a part in it too. And actually, I think you point out too that those tortoises probably existed throughout the world.
Yeah, they did. Giant tortoises, they're land animals, and they used to exist on every continent except for Australia and Antarctica. And they mostly died off in the Pleistocene extinctions 13,000 or so years ago. And we think they were just overhunted by humans. We don't have evidence of that exactly. but they managed to survive on the Galapagos Islands and also in a set of islands in the Indian Ocean called the Aldabra Atoll. And the idea is that those were so isolated from human populations that nobody was preying on the tortoises until all of this maritime travel really started up in the 16th century.
Describe there may be people who say, where the heck are the Galapagos Islands and what are they like? Describe them for us.
Yeah, I certainly had no idea where they were before I set out to go for the first time. They are an Ecuadorian territory, so they are off the coast of South America in the state of Ecuador. They are on the equator, about 600 miles off into the Pacific Ocean. So they're not nearly as far out from continental South America as they are, as Hawaii is from the U.S.
Yeah, and what are the islands like? I mean, they're made from lava?
Yeah, they're all lava-based. They're all volcanic in origin. The easternmost side of the island is the older side, and the westernmost side is the younger side. And so the western side is still volcanically active. So you get eruptions. There was an eruption last month when I was there. So on those volcanic islands, the westernmost islands are more mountainous and more difficult terrain. The easternmost islands are kind of hills now, but not nearly the kind of majestic peaks that we expect of a volcano.
Yeah. And when Darwin was not necessarily the preservationist that we would kind of, that many might want to ascribe to him.
No, it's an ahistorical idea that Darwin was a conservationist. But today you go to Galapagos and there are statues of Darwin everywhere. And so I think it's one of the chapters in the book I write about how we go to Galapagos to walk in Darwin's footsteps. And that's possible because of conservation work. But that doesn't mean that Darwin himself was a conservationist. You know, he ate tortoises in the Galapagos, and people who go there today and walk in his footsteps can't do many of the things that he actually did, like eat the tortoises or throw marine iguanas into the sea.
Well, and yeah, he used to take hunters. I mean, he went with hunters so he could find them.
Yeah, he did. He did some hunting himself, and he also, on one of the islands called Santiago in the archipelago, he camped out for 3 days with penal colonists from another island, and they were his guides around. He paid them to kind of guide them and to show him where the tortoises were on the island.
I can't remember if he wrote about liking the meat or not.
He did like the meat. He didn't love it as much as some other people did, though.
Yeah, some people really liked it and some hated it, I guess. Well, we'll give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question, you're welcome to phone in or maybe an experience to share. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us as well. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Carolyn in Platteville, or Carlin, is it? I'm sorry, from Platteville. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a story about my parents visited there for their honeymoon back in 87. And the ship they were staying on made a really big deal about making sure that everyone collected their trash and didn't litter it all so that the ship could take care of it. And then one night a passenger saw that they just dumped all the trash over the side of the boat. So after that, all of the other passengers were very careful to hoard all of their trash in their rooms because they did not want to damage this beautiful environment.
That's a really tragic story. I've heard of things like that happening, though, and I think that this is one of the problems of ecotourism is that a lot of the ships understand what it is that we expect a responsible company to do, but it's really difficult to get rid of trash. They're going to send it back to the continent, which is 600 miles away, or it goes into the island and it's burned in a dump.
Yeah.
Or dumped into the sea,
unfortunately. Or dumped into the sea, unfortunately. Well, that's the kind of story that makes you, that would kind of ruin a trip for a lot of people who would be visiting there.
Absolutely.
Given the mindset that they had. It brings to mind, though, what have been brought to the islands that have created some interesting issues, things like rats and goats and other animals. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the rats and goats have been in the islands for centuries now. There is an endemic species of rat, but the rats that are really problematic are the Norway rats, the black rats that we all know and love and hate.
Mm-hmm.
But the sailors that used to come they unintentionally let rats ashore, and they often intentionally left goats and other animals ashore because those goats would procreate and then they'd be able to come back in a couple months and have another source of meat. But the goats and the rats are really problematic for native species, including the tortoises, because the rats will prey on tortoise eggs. They can kind of dig them up, and they'll also prey on juveniles. I've seen pictures of baby tortoises with their little legs gnawed off. It's really sad. And the goats compete with tortoises for limited vegetation on some islands. And so there have been these massive eradication campaigns over the last couple decades.
Well, let's talk some more about this whole relationship, because I think it's really important. I think Ecuador took the islands over and what was it?
About way back in 1832.
Yeah, 1832. And so there was a long period where Ecuador was, and still, I guess they're still in charge of mm-hmm. the place. And the real conservation efforts didn't happen for a long time.
Yeah, for the first 100-150 years or so that it was an Ecuadorian territory, there wasn't a lot of conservation work going on. The priority for the Ecuadorian government, and I think this is true of most governments with like the Manifest Destiny in the United States, it was to secure their sovereignty over the islands because they had these really rich fisheries. But they wanted to make the islands themselves profitable for the state. And the way they thought to do that was through these agricultural colonies that were often headed by really elite Ecuadorians. But then the laborers were often taken from debtors' prisons. They were like homeless people that were taken off the streets of the cities in Ecuador. And so it wasn't until the 1930s that conservationists really started to get concerned about what was going on in Galapagos and killing of native species, in particular clearing of areas for sugarcane plantations. And those conservationists involved people in the U.S. and Europe and Ecuadorian scientists as well. And so the first conservationist legislation was passed in the mid-1930s, but there wasn't really anyone there to enforce it. And so it wasn't until the 1950s that things really started getting rolling.
Talking today with Elizabeth Hennessy. She's a geographer, assistant professor of history and environmental studies, and her book is called On the Backs of Tortoises, Darwin, the Galapagos, and the Fate of an Evolutionary Eden. Hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today. Sasha Van Allen, our producer, on-air producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at a new book today. It's called On the Backs of Tortoises, Darwin, the Galapagos, and the Fate of an Evolutionary Eden, written by Elizabeth Hennessy. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. She's a geographer, assistant professor of history and environmental studies at the UW-Madison. Join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share. We had a good one just a few minutes ago. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'd like to talk about, we're talking about this whole time when conservationists, environmentalists sort of really started looking at this, and over time, it's evolved a bit. But what was the kind of the early thinking? I know one of the had to do with people and not having people around there.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the United States, this was true too. But in the mid-20th century, most conservationists were thinking about this pristine ideal. So when we created our national parks, we didn't want people to be living within those national parks. And the idea was the same in the Galapagos, that because there wasn't an indigenous human population. And in the 1950s, only about 500 people lived in the archipelago, so it was pretty unpopulated. And so conservationists wanted to maintain that. They thought that the really unique animals that evolved in the Galapagos did so because of the isolation from the continent and from other species, and they wanted to try and protect that isolation as much as possible. The catch-22 was that in order to get the Ecuadorian government's permission to protect the islands, as 97% of the islands today are a national park, to get that permission, they had to promise a revenue stream for the government, because the government priority was to make the islands profitable. And so what they promised was nature tourism. And it has taken off far more than anyone, I think, at that point could have imagined it would.
And there was not, as I think I recall you talking about in your book, there was not a lot of input from people who actually lived there. I mean, it was pretty much they were viewed as interlopers almost and were not consulted ever over the years about the islands.
This is a problem that's changed a lot, gratefully, in the last 2 decades or so. But yeah, when conservation started, it was mostly foreign scientists who came in and they built what's called the Charles Darwin Research Station. The Ecuadorian government built the Galapagos National Park, but they did so about 10 years after the foreign scientists first arrived. And those scientists employed a lot of local men that had grown up in Galapagos. They'd grown up hunting feral goats and cattle to feed their families. And so they knew the landscape really well. They'd also grown up as fishers. And so they employed those people to be their field hands and to show them how to do surveys of all the endemic species. But they didn't so much consult them about how to manage nature. The overwhelming sense, and this is true in other places as well, not just in Galapagos, was that these white scientists knew best how to take care of nature. You can imagine that wasn't terribly popular with everyone there.
Yeah. And there are things that that are done over time, and I've had some international experience myself mostly in the Caribbean. And I've noted that same thing happening oftentimes in that area where I worked. And here I lost my train of thought, so I'm going to go to Mary Ellen, who has a question, and then I'll come back to what I was thinking about here. Mary Ellen in West Bend, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I had a wonderful trip to the Galapagos with Rhodes Scholar a year ago and experienced the mating of the tortoises.
Oh, wow.
Stayed on the island of Floriana with just a wonderful family. And as you said, they were local and the food was local. There was so much care. We also saw the blue-footed boobies, and we also wondered about the survival of the fish that they feed on with that recent oil spill that's occurred. Sure. I just worry about that.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Mary Ellen.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And the oil spill actually this time wasn't as bad as I think some of the headlines implied that it was. What happened was that in one of the bays on San Cristobal Island, there were, cargo ships bring most goods out from the continent, including fuel for people's cars and cooking gas and whatnot. And they were unloading one of these barges and dropped a container off the crane, kind of tumbled over and fell into the bay. But luckily, there wasn't a lot of oil in the container when it fell, and the park was able to act pretty quickly to contain it. And so the reports that I've read have said that the wildlife managers who were sent out actually didn't even find any animals that had been directly impacted. Of course, fish are harder to find in that kind of situation,
well, sure.
But it wasn't a big spill this time, gratefully.
Gratefully. Mary Ellen, thank you so much. Shelby in Marshfield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Shelby.
Hi, this is Shelby from Marshfield, and I was in the Galapagos Islands about 15 to 20 years ago, and it was a trip that I will never forget. I was on a cruise ship, and the cruise ship docked quite a ways out. We had to, according to their rules and regulations, and then when we got off the cruise ship, we had to walk through this trough of water so that we had nothing on our feet to take onto the islands to hurt any of the species there. And we walked around the islands, and there were paths, and we were instructed to stay on the path so we didn't hurt any of the vegetation, and, of course, no littering. And I did go scuba diving while I was there, and it was absolutely incredible. The rocks, the stones, I never in my life have seen such. I felt like I was in an aquarium because there were all these beautiful fish, and it was just absolutely incredible.
Oh, Shelby, thank you so much.
It sounds like you were a model tourist, Shelby. I agree that I've only been snorkeling in Galapagos myself, but it's incredible. I saw a whale once. I've seen lots of sharks and octopi, and sea turtles. It's really an incredible experience. And the water trough that you mentioned and the boat staying far out, that's all part of the quarantine process and the way that the national park is able to manage tourists who are going to the archipelago. So it's really important so that the invasive species don't spread from island to island.
Shelby, thanks so much. Did you encounter a lot of local people while you were there, or get to go to one of the towns?
Local people, but I was impressed with how they really wanted to maintain the way they wanted the Galapagos Islands, because there were even security guards by that big tortoise. There were two security guards there so that no one would feed it or, you know, damage it in any way.
Hmm. Yeah, the national park is really protective of the animals. And one of the core rules of going to Galapagos is you have to stay 2 meters away from any of the wildlife. Even if the wildlife are the ones walking up to you, it's your job as a tourist to kind of back off and give them their space.
Thank you very much for calling, Shelby. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And I want to go back to what I was thinking about earlier that flew out of my brain for a second. And that is unintended consequences of things when we had been talking about never consulting local people really about their own thoughts about the relationship between what was going on the islands. And you tell a story in the book about the goats, that it was decided that the goats needed to be eliminated. So, I mean, tell that story and talk about it a little bit.
Sure. So in the early 2000s, conservationists working in the Galapagos and the tour guides were also reporting back, too, that they saw just devastated landscapes because their goats were just overgrazing. There was no greenery on some of these islands. And so they put together a campaign and got money for internationally to do this eradication campaign of goats and other ungulate species. And they killed over about 5-6 years, somewhere in the vicinity of 150,000 goats, sometimes out of helicopters with semi-automatic rifles, because the landscape in Galapagos is really difficult to hunt on foot. But it wasn't necessarily, it was a great success in the world of island conservation. It's become a model for other islands and other parts of the world now. But for people who lived on some of the islands where they were doing this hunting, they weren't so excited about this, in part because they didn't employ local hunters, because they weren't seen as being qualified enough hunters. They didn't have the sharpshooting techniques to be able to do this. But also people, there's been a long history in the Galapagos, and this isn't so much true in the last 10 years, but people are, really informed by the way they grow up and the kind of relationships that exist. But there was a long history of the park kind of treating people as a problem for conservation instead of as partners for conservation. And so this eradication campaign was read through that lens. And so people were very upset about it. Sometimes people told us in interviews they were shooting at us too, not just the goats, which of course is not actually true. But
no.
It's people's perception. And they feel often that they don't have a place in Galapagos, that it's really just for the tortoises and other animals, and that they themselves don't really belong. So people will sometimes refer to themselves as invasive species.
And so not everybody is necessarily happy with the tortoises.
Not all the time. I would
Not
say
all the, time.
the vast majority of people in the Galapagos are very happy about the tortoises. They don't see them very often. If you have land in some of the highlands, it's where the tortoises like to hang out most of the time because they're nice and green. There's lots of grass to eat. Those people would run into them. Tortoises will walk onto your farm, and sometimes they're going to eat some of your crops. So sometimes they're a nuisance species. But I think most people, live through tourism. It's the lifeblood of the local economy. But there are people in Galapagos, and the fishers are the best example, who don't fit into that tourism economy and don't fit into conservation work, but instead see the national park rules as kind of impinging on their livelihoods. And so there have been a couple instances one was in the mid-1990s, another in the mid-2000s, where fishers have actually taken tortoises hostage, so to speak.
Yeah.
And targeted them. Some tortoises have been slayed in what appear to be political protests. And this is not because the fishers hate the tortoises. Sometimes they eat them when they're out at sea. But because they know that they're such a powerful international symbol that by targeting them, they can hopefully get their voices heard in a more serious way.
Yeah, it sort of backfired.
It did kind of backfire. I think that there's someone, an anthropologist that I quote in the book, saying like, oh, well, the question that the fishers were implicitly asking is like, oh, well, are these tortoises really more important than our lives? And the international answer was yes, they are. Mm-hmm. People really want to protect the tortoises. And
I was thinking about this, thinking about Wisconsin when you were talking about some of this in the book. I can remember doing a show about wolves and someone from Milwaukee calling and talking about saving the wolves and protecting them. And then somebody from northern Wisconsin who said, would you mind if I brought a couple of wolves down and put them in Milwaukee County?
It's a really different thing to live with wildlife sometimes than it is to care about them from afar.
Yeah, it definitely is. Susan in Fairchild, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you very much. What a great show. I emigrated to Alaska for about 35 years. And as I was, my husband and I were deciding to come back, and our last area was the Juneau area, there was an earthquake that happened in the waters outside of what they used to call the San Juan Islands, and now it has a in British Columbia, that we felt up in the Juneau Sitka area. And it was caused by, perhaps, a side by cause, and I don't want to sound like I'm crazy here, but a person from Canada dumped, and so this is a rich person, over 100 metric tons of iron into that water area. And some folks thought that could have, strapped or changed, dropping so fast, changed the floor, caused the earthquake, assisted the earthquake. But as I researched it a little bit, because I was just so interested in earthquakes and how they pop up all over the world, the same person that made this dump had also made one outside of the Galapagos. I don't know the time reference to when it was. I'm thinking that this incident that I recall and was around 2012 in Alaska.
So you're thinking it might have been about the perhaps about the same time. Are you familiar? Thanks, Susan. Are you familiar with this at all? At least the dumping in the Galapagos area?
No, that's a really astounding story, Susan, and I haven't heard that in Galapagos. There is a lot of volcanic activity in Galapagos, and the islands sit at the conjunction of three different tectonic plates that are kind of pushing together, and so that's why the islands first emerged from the sea, and it's why they continue to be volcanically active.
Wow, that's quite a story. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it very much. Well, there are a lot of unintended consequences to things that we do. As you talked about the tortoises themselves, the first two that I thought of, well, the first one was Lonesome George.
Of course, everyone's favorite tortoise.
Yeah, tell the background on that, because you talk about Lonesome George appears many times through the course of your book.
He does, and I was lucky to get to meet him while I was volunteering at the breeding center where he lived for 40 years before he died in 2012. But George is famous because he was not the biggest tortoise or the oldest tortoise, but he was the last of his particular species. So each island in volcano in Galapagos more or less has its own species of tortoise.
Yeah.
And George was from an island called Pinta. And it's thought that sailors from the past and fishers in the 20th century killed off all of George's, all of his brethren, and that he was the only tortoise that park guards and a scientist found in 1971 when they were doing a search for snails on the island, actually, that came across this tortoise. And so people that were tortoise scientists got really excited because they thought they were extinct. And so the next year they brought George into captivity. And then over the preceding 40 years, they really wanted to breed George. And so there was an international campaign and a $10,000 reward to zoos around the world asking if they had another tortoise from Pinta, hopefully a female, so that they could breed George. Nobody ever had one. And they put some tortoises with George and his corral who were from a different island that they thought would be most closely related to his species. But they never procreated. And it turned out that George had an anatomical
problem
and just wasn't able to reproduce.
But they did find, as you were saying, sort of a hybrid.
Yeah, there's been a lot of tortoise news in the last couple weeks. A team of scientists and park guards just a couple of weeks ago got back, I think this was actually just last week, got back from a volcano called Wolf Volcano that is on a different island from Pinta. But they had found about a decade ago some hybrid species. And so the tortoises that were hybrids from Pinta and the population that's native to Wolf. So they had interbred these two different species, and they think that they did that over the last 300 years or so, which means that it was sailors who moved the tortoises from island to island. And so these people that we usually think of as responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of tortoises, which is true, actually inadvertently now have opened up the opportunity to save the species. And so they brought this one tortoise back into captivity with the hopes of finding other Pinta hybrid tortoises so that they could breed and replace George's
and they
population.
Found some.
They did find some. They found several the first time they were out, but they just took blood samples because they didn't know just by looking at the tortoises where they were from. But they tag them, and so they have records now when they go out and they're looking for tortoises with particular numbers. And so they can know and they pull them, but they've only come into contact with one from Pinta that they were able to take blood samples from the first trip. So, you know, these animals move around. The volcanoes are large and really difficult terrain, and so they can be really hard to find.
I want you to talk about your own experience there, because that informs, obviously, the book and a lot of what you write about in the book. But you've had stayed there for extended periods of time and visited often.
Yeah, I think I've been about 10 times over the last 12 years. I went for the first time in 2007, right when I started graduate school. And I have lived in Galapagos off and on for about a year total. It was about 6 months total when I was doing the big stint of my research. And it was a really remarkable experience to be able to live there. I think most people in the U.S. don't have any idea that people actually live in the Galapagos. So people often ask me where I stay. And I, you know, I rent apartments, I stay in hotels, and it took me a while to figure out why that was an interesting question. And it's because I think people think that I'm camping or on a sailboat or something the whole time. But there's actually, you know, it's about 30,000 people live in Galapagos today. There are four small towns, and they're pretty similar to small towns that you'd find in rural Wisconsin as well.
And you enjoyed your life there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really, the locals say a tranquil place to live. It's a great place to raise kids because the economy is good. It's safe. The community is really small, so people know each other. And it really helped shape, for me, an understanding of why it's so important to understand the local population and their worries and their fears, but also their desires for conservation and their input into how to do conservation.
Is that part of the change that you've seen? You talked about how things have improved over the last 10 years or so. Explain how that or what that is and how it may have been informed in part by local people.
Sure. So over the last 10 years or so, the park has shifted from a model in which local people really weren't, they were kind of seen as outside the conservation system, outside the ecosystem. And now they're really conceptualized as partners for conservation. And there's a huge recognition that we need to do interdisciplinary research. We need to understand how ecosystems and social systems intersect with each other. And I think that, you know, the park has done a lot of participatory meetings when they do their management planning, talking to people about what the priorities for conservation should be. And for decades, it's been saving endemic species, which is a really important thing. I don't disagree with that. But there are other issues in the communities like water quality, education, and these things are also really important for conservation work as well.
So what do you what would your ideal be for the Galapagos?
This is the million-dollar question. You know, I think that it's really important that conservation continue in this path of working with local people as partners and trying to understand what their priorities are. Right now, there's a system in Galapagos, it's really meant It's all set up to serve tourists.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important because that's the economy, and that's, I think, in some ways not going to change. But what that means for the people that live there is that they are always secondary, that they didn't evolve in the islands, so there isn't a long human population in the islands, and the way that all the businesses run is to support tourists. And so the people who live there are, you know, they work in support industries, they work in hotels and restaurants, and they're able to benefit from it, but they're, I think, don't always feel a lot of ownership. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would like to see change.
Yeah. And for the islands itself, you at one point you talk about conservationists wanting to take the island back to what it was in 1530 or whenever it was that Darwin landed there. And that kind of just goes against the whole face of what evolution is about.
Exactly. And this was the kind of paradox that really got me interested in Galapagos as a place, too, because in 2001, there was a policy document published by a bunch of biologists, very well-meaning biologists, and said that they had one more chance to go back to Eden, to go to 1534, which is the year before a Spanish friar first washed up in the Galapagos by accident. And so that's the first written record we have of any Westerner visiting. And so they wanted to go back to before the human touch. And of course, it's not possible because we can't rewind evolution. And every biologist and conservationist knows that. But there are these like imaginaries, the idea of the pristine, the idea of Eden are so powerful that it still becomes a goal that you work toward as much as you possibly could. But yeah, there's no room for local populations in that vision.
Yeah, and that has to be there.
Absolutely.
Well, you've written a wonderful, entertaining and interesting book, and I want to thank you, Elizabeth, for taking time to be with us today. It was really a joy talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. It was great for me, too.
You know, you mentioned water quality on the islands, and it reminded me of the show, our next portion of our program that's coming up, which has to do with water quality only a lot closer to home, water quality in Lake Superior. So we'll talk about that next, but take a look at Elizabeth Hennessy's book. It's called On the Backs of Tortoises, Darwin, the Galapagos, and the Fate of an Evolutionary Eden. Lots of interesting stuff in that book. And coming up, you're going to learn a lot about water quality as it relates to Lake Superior. Next on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller.